I'm Chris Kresser, and this is Revolution Health Radio. Hey everybody, it's Chris Kresser. Welcome to another episode of Revolution Health Radio. This week we have a question from Stacy. Let's give it a listen.
Hello, my name is Stacy. Thank you so much, Chris, for all you do. I absolutely love your website and your podcast. I use it as a resource for myself and for my patients. I'd like to ask a question that I've really tried to research very hard, and I've had trouble because most of the research on whole grains compares it to the regular SAD diet with processed flours, the white stuff, the sugar. So it's really hard, you know, because the evidence will, of course, say that whole grains are better. But I want to know if outside of food sensitivities are gluten-free whole grains that are unprocessed, not turned into flours, things like quinoa, rice, brown rice, things that you're cooking in a pot, you know, and eating essentially, are they inflammatory? Are they bad for our microbiome? I haven't seen evidence to support this. I think that if people have a food sensitivity to it, and for sure that happens, you know, especially with IBD and other autoimmune conditions. It's very common to have food sensitivities even to gluten-free whole grains. But outside of having a food sensitivity to it, is there evidence that everyone should be off of gluten-free whole unprocessed grains? I haven't been able to see that. Is it true that they're inflammatory for those that don't have an immune reaction because they're, you know, it's a food sensitivity for them? Is it true that they're not good for the microbiome? The research I've seen shows that it improves biodiversity of the microbiome, whole grains. So that would be what I'd like to ask you today. If anyone can help me with this question, I think it could be you. You do mention, you know, that the paleo is a template. And I think that might be part of the answer. You know, it's a good place to start, but not necessarily everyone needs to be off of them, off of, you know, whole grains or legumes or things like that, you know, especially if they're prepared in the right way. So that's my question for you today. Sorry, it's a little long-winded. Thank you.
Okay, Stacy, thanks for sending your question. I'm going to expand on this a little bit and talk about legumes as well as grains, because I often get questions about whether legumes can be part of a healthy diet. So of course, paleo dogma holds that we should never eat grains or legumes. And there are usually two arguments to support this idea. The first is that grains and legumes contain lectins. Lectins are a type of protein that combine the cell membranes. And animal studies have shown that lectins can impair growth, damage the lining of the intestine, destroy skeletal muscle, and interfere with the function of the pancreas, among other things. That sounds pretty bad, right? But not so fast, though. There are several reasons that these results probably shouldn't be extrapolated to humans. The first is that animals in these studies consumed an enormous amount of lectins, much more than a human would get from a varied diet that included some grains and legumes. Second, most lectins are destroyed by cooking. So for example, cooking legumes for as little as 15 minutes or pressure cooking them for 7.5 minutes almost completely inactivates the lectins that they contain, leaving no residual lectin activity in properly cooked legumes and grains. The results vary a little bit depending on the legume and the grain, but that's a general rule. Cooking does inactivate most lectins. What's more, other components in food like simple sugars can bind to lectins and diminish their toxic effect. So even if there is a small amount of lectin left after cooking, it's unlikely that it will have a detrimental effect given the presence of simple carbohydrates in both legumes and grains that can bind to those proteins. Finally, if lectins really are a problem, then we'll have to cut out a lot more than grains and legumes from our diet if we want to avoid them. It turns out that lectins are present in over 50 different fruits, vegetables, spices, and commonly eaten plants, including carrots, zucchini, melon, grapes, cherries, raspberries, blackberries, garlic, and mushrooms, to name a few. every plant we eat contains some small amount of toxin, since this is how plants defend themselves. And in the majority of these cases, these low levels of toxins don't harm us. And in fact, they may even provide health benefits. So for example, many of the compounds that we call antioxidants, like polyphenols found in blueberries, dark chocolate, etc., are actually prooxidants that cause mild oxidative stress. And by doing that, they upregulate our body's natural antioxidant defense system. So this is a little known fact about so-called antioxidants. They actually benefit us by promoting a little bit of oxidative stress that our body then responds to in a hormetic or favorable way. The one lectin we may want to exercise caution with, though, is peanut lectin, since both raw peanuts and peanut oil have really high lectin content. And there is some data in animals that suggests that peanut lectin may contribute to atherosclerosis by stimulating the growth of smooth muscle and pulmonary arterial cells. However, other research, including clinical trials in both animals and humans, have found that peanuts and even peanut oil actually reduces cardiovascular risk factors and thus may protect against heart disease. So I think the jury is still out even in that case. The second argument typically made against grains and legumes is that they contain phytic acid. Phytic acid is the storage form of phosphorus that's found in many plants, especially in the bran or the whole of grains and nuts and seeds. Although herbivores like cows and sheep can digest phytate or phytic acid, humans cannot. This is bad news because phytic acid binds to minerals, especially iron and zinc, in food and prevents us from absorbing them. It's important to note that phytic acid does not leach minerals that are already stored in the body. It only inhibits the absorption of minerals from food in which phytic acid is present. So if you eat rice or oats that have phytic acid in them, then you don't absorb as many nutrients as you would otherwise from those foods if the phytic acid wasn't present. But the phytic acid isn't going to remove nutrients that are already stored in the body. Phytate can also interfere with enzymes that we need to digest our food, including pepsin, which is needed for the breakdown of proteins in the stomach, and amylase, which is required for the breakdown of starch. Phytic acid also inhibits the enzyme trypsin, which is needed for protein digestion in the small intestine. So again, at first glance, it sounds pretty bad, right? You know, it sounds like we shouldn't be eating any phytic acid at all. But while it's true that diets that are high in phytate contribute to mineral deficiencies, it's also true that humans can tolerate moderate amounts of it without harm. And this might be because our gut bacteria produce enzymes that break down phytate and thus make us able to extract the nutrients that the body needs. In fact, there's even some evidence that phytic acid has beneficial effects. It's been shown to prevent the formation of free radicals, which makes it an antioxidant, prevent the accumulation of heavy metals in the body, and plays a role in cellular communication. So the problem with telling people to strictly avoid grains and legumes because they contain phytate is that, just like legumes, many other healthy foods in the diet, including paleo-friendly foods, contain substantially higher amounts of phytic acid than legumes or grains. So for example, a single serving of trail mix, which is that, you know, beloved paleo snack favorite, is likely to be much higher in phytic acid than a serving of lentils or whole grains. Cacao beans, which we make chocolate from, have about the same amount of phytic acid as most other beans and legumes. And spinach and Swiss chard are higher in phytate than almost any legume, nut, or seed. It's also important to note that phytic acid can often be at least partly broken down by certain food processing methods, such as soaking and roasting. So I wrote an article a while back called "Another Reason Not to Go Nuts on Nuts," suggesting that you soak and dehydrate or roast nuts before eating them, for exactly this reason. In the case of legumes, studies have shown that soaking at room temperature for 18 hours or at 140 degrees Fahrenheit for 3 hours eliminates between 30 to 70% of phytic acid, depending on the legume. And for grains, it really varies depending on the grain. Some grains have phytase, which is the enzyme that breaks down phytic acid, naturally present in the grain. And so those grains typically don't need to be soaked for as long, whereas other grains don't have phytase and need to be soaked for longer. And generally, it's better to add some kind of acidic medium, like a fermented dairy, kefir, lemon juice, or something like that, to the soaking water to help activate the enzymatic process. Some of you might be familiar with the Weston A. Price approach to eating. It's basically a paleo diet that also includes properly prepared grains and legumes. So, for example, if you're going to eat oatmeal, you would soak the oats overnight in room temperature water with maybe a little bit of kefir, and then you would drain that in the morning, and then you would cook those soaked oats. Or same if you eat brown rice, or if you eat lentils or other legumes, you would soak them and prepare them properly. And this is, in fact, what all traditional cultures who consumed whole grains and legumes did. Whether you're talking about indigenous people in what is now Mexico or Central America, they did that with corn and cornmeal. People who lived in Africa who consumed, you know, various grains and legumes, and people all over the world who Weston Price studied, people in what's now Switzerland, they made a natural sourdough rye bread, which is a fermentation process, of course, that would break down the phytic acid and make the nutrients more bioavailable. So this is a common practice in any culture that traditionally ate whole grains and legumes. And the problem is today, almost nobody does that, you know, except people who are aware of the importance of this, or maybe even some traditional cultures who have still maintained their, you know, people living in the industrialized world who've maintained some connection with their traditional ways. So given everything that we've talked about so far, you might think I'm a fan of whole grains and legumes, but there are several reasons why I think many people may need to limit their consumption of these foods, and why I still do recommend a paleo template as the best starting place for most people. The first reason comes down to nutrient density. And optimizing this, the amount of nutrients that we consume in our diet on a day-to-day basis, should be one of the main goals that we have when it comes to food. Micronutrients are the fuel for our bodies, and suboptimal amounts of any of them will cause significant problems. Nutrient deficiency is just widespread in the industrialized world. More than a third of Americans are deficient in essential nutrients, and that's using the RDA, or recommended dietary allowance, which is the threshold at which acute deficiency symptoms occur. That doesn't mean that the RDA is the optimal intake level of a nutrient. It's just the level at which we, you know, start to see very acute symptoms of deficiency. And if we used instead the optimal intake of a given nutrient, the number or the percentage of Americans and other people living in both the developed and developing worlds would be that are deficient in nutrients would be much higher. The most nutrient-dense foods are organ meats, shellfish, spices and herbs, meat and fish, nuts and seeds, and fruits and vegetables. And I shared some references to these nutrient density studies in my first book, Your Personal Paleo Code, which was later published as The Paleo Cure. So if you've read that book, you've probably seen some of this research. Of course, those foods should sound familiar because they make up what we call a paleo diet or a paleo template. Whole grains and legumes do contain some nutrients, but they're generally lower on the list than many of the foods I just mentioned when it comes to nutrient density. Organ meats and shellfish are orders of magnitude higher in terms of nutrient content than grains and legumes, for example. So for that reason alone, we shouldn't base our diets on whole grains and legumes. And this, of course, is one of the reasons why vegetarians and vegans do typically have much higher rates of nutrient deficiency, because they consume significantly higher amounts of grain, whole grain and legume. And often the diet can be based around these foods. And that's if they're doing well. You know, there's, of course, also the junk food vegetarian who's eating mostly, you know, refined flour and sugar and you know, a whole bunch of stuff that's not meat or animal products, but is not particularly, not only not nutrient dense, but also, you know, full of stuff that can be harmful. So there are certain groups that also may need to limit or even completely avoid grains and legumes. One is people with autoimmune disease, which now affects up to 1 in 6 Americans. There's some evidence, and you know, a lot of it's anecdotal, but there is some evidence suggesting that compounds in these foods, including lectins, may be problematic for people with autoimmune disease. And this is also true of other foods like eggs and nightshades and nuts and seeds, which are proscribed on the autoimmune protocol, or AIP, which I'm sure many people listening to this have heard of and may even be on themselves. And I think the evidence for the AIP has been mostly anecdotal so far. However, there was a peer-reviewed study recently done on it at UC San Diego that I'm going to be writing about soon. And the study had actually pretty impressive results. So I'm really excited to see. I mean, it's kind of miraculous that that study got done in the first place, because as I'm sure many of you know, getting funding for a study that's purely a dietary intervention when most medical research is funded by pharmaceutical companies is exceedingly difficult. But what happened is a gastroenterologist at Scripps down in San Diego was introduced to AIP after witnessing one of her patients with ulcerative colitis, which is an autoimmune disease, made a really astonishing recovery using that diet. And so this GI doc decided to put together a study to formally investigate it both in patients with UC or ulcerative colitis and also in Crohn's disease patients, which is another autoimmune gastrointestinal disease. And you know, the results were pretty phenomenal. And I think it's kind of a landmark study because it really, for the first time, showed that AIP was able to induce clinical remission by week six in 11 out of 15 participants. That's 73% of study participants. And all 11 maintained clinical remission during the maintenance phase of the study. So this is quite remarkable. 73% remission rate rivals even the most aggressive drug therapies, you know, steroids and immunosuppressive drugs like Imuran and Remicade, which have side effects leading all the way up to death. And they were able to accomplish this with just a dietary intervention. So even though most of the evidence for anecdotal is AIP, now we now have some peer-reviewed evidence supporting its use in autoimmune gastrointestinal disease, and certainly in my work with patients in the clinic, I've seen it be incredibly helpful for people with a number of different autoimmune diseases. Another group that may need to limit their whole grains and legume consumption is people with gut problems, you know, independently of autoimmune gut issues. This is a huge number of people, frankly. IBS is now the second leading cause of people missing work. Virtually every patient that comes to my clinic has gut issues. Many people that I just talk to, because of my profession, a lot of friends and family members come to me for advice, and in many cases, it's related to gut issues. Yeah, I think it's pretty safe to say that a large percentage of the population suffers from dysfunctional gut to some degree or another. And grains and legumes are often hard on the gut, and many people with gut issues feel better when they avoid or limit these foods. And one reason for that is that most legumes and some grains contain FODMAPs. And these are a class of carbohydrates that are poorly absorbed by some people and can provide food for bacteria that may be present in the small intestine where they shouldn't be. So people with SIBO or people with fungal overgrowth or other intestinal conditions, the FODMAPs can be problematic. In these cases, I've found that soaking and the other proper steps of preparation that I mentioned before for grains and legumes can help to some degree. I have patients, for example, who cannot tolerate unsoaked grains or legumes, but can tolerate some amount of soaked and properly prepared grains and legumes. So, you know, experimentation can pay off there. But in general, I've typically found that people with these kinds of gut conditions do feel better when they avoid these foods. So let's just kind of wrap it up. I mean, when I wrote my first book, I suggested that the best approach is to start with a 30-day paleo reset. And I hope it's clear why now. Even though whole grains and legumes may be, you may be able to include them in small amounts as part of an overall healthy diet, it's best to try a period of time, usually 30 days or sometimes more, especially if you have an autoimmune disease, where you're not eating them at all. Because that's the only way you'll get a chance to see how they're truly affecting you. And then after you're finished with that reset, you can start slowly adding back in the what I call gray area foods like grains and legumes, which we've talked about today, and also including dairy, particularly full fat and fermented dairy, which I've written and talked about a lot in the past, and then see if you tolerate them. And if you tolerate them without difficulty, I don't see a problem with including these gray area foods in your diet with one caveat, which is that they're not replacing more nutrient-dense foods, or two caveats, I guess, and you eat them in relatively small or moderate amounts. I've never seen any convincing research that whole grains and legumes, especially when they're properly prepared, are significant contributors to the chronic disease epidemic. I mean, let's face it, we didn't get to where we are with 2/3 of Americans being overweight and 1/3 of Americans being obese by eating quinoa and lentils. We got here by eating pizza and drinking big gulps and having grain-based desserts and fried foods and all kinds of other processed and refined crap. That's what has caused the chronic disease epidemic, not, you know, whole grains and legumes. And the same is true for dairy, which I've talked about at length. If you look at the research on full-fat dairy overall, it's very encouraging. And it's really comes down to individual tolerance in that case. You know, there are people who are intolerant of lactose, quite a few people actually, 2/3 of the population of the world. And there are people who are intolerant of the proteins in dairy. So those people obviously will not do well with dairy, but for people who don't have either of those issues, and even for people with lactose intolerance, they can consume full-fat fermented dairy. You know, foods like kefir and yogurt, especially if they're made at home, where all of the fermented to all the point where lactose is removed. Ghee and butter and full-fat cream, which don't have very much lactose or protein, but it's really an individual thing, but the research shows that they're well tolerated, they're beneficial when they're well tolerated. So I think that sums it up here. So the moral of the story here is that if you're able to eat small amounts of properly prepared whole grains and legumes without any difficulty or worsening of your symptoms, and you're still eating a very nutrient-dense diet that contains organ meats and shellfish and herbs and spices and meat and fish and nuts and seeds and fresh fruits and vegetables, then that's fantastic. Lucky you, you'll have a broader and more diverse diet and fewer limitations. If you have autoimmune disease or gut issues, you may need to be more careful with these foods, and it would be even more important for you to do a reset diet where you eliminate these foods for a period of time before adding them back in to see how you tolerate them. So speaking of books, I wanted to mention that my next book called Unconventional Medicine is coming out on November 7th. I'm really, really excited about this book. It proposes a 3-part solution to the growing epidemic of chronic disease that's destroying our quality of life, bankrupting our governments, and threatening the health of future generations. Our current conventional approach to what I call it sick care rather than healthcare, because that's really what it is when you think about it, it focuses on suppressing symptoms and managing disease rather than preventing and reversing disease by addressing the root cause. So we desperately need a new solution of true healthcare that can reverse these problems and restore people's health and empower patients to take charge of their own health and inspire healthcare practitioners to do the kind of work that they envisioned doing, you know, when they decided to enter medicine or healthcare in the first place. And Unconventional Medicine lays out a vision for how we can do that. So you can learn more about it and sign up to be notified when it's released and for some really cool pre-launch stuff that we're going to be doing with the books, some free stuff and bells and whistles. That's unconventionalmedicinebook.com. It's kind of a tight timeline here. We've got a lot of other balls in the air and things going on, but I'm super, super excited about this book, and I think you're going to love it, and hope you can join us in pushing this movement forward to reinvent medicine and healthcare. I think it's something, it's, you know, it's really my purpose here to end chronic disease and to create a new way of doing this. Okay, everybody, thanks for listening. Keep sending your questions to chriskresser.com/podcast question, and I'll talk to you in a couple weeks. That's the end of this episode of Revolution Health Radio. If you appreciate the show and want to help me create a healthier and happier world, please head over to iTunes and leave us a review. They really do make a difference. If you'd like to ask a question for me to answer on a future episode, you can do that at chriskresser.com/podcast question. You can also leave a suggestion for someone you'd like me to interview there. If you're on social media, you can follow me at twitter.com/ChrisKresser or facebook.com/ChrisKresserLAC. I post a lot of articles and research that I do throughout the week there that never makes it to the blog or podcast, so it's a great way to stay abreast of the latest developments. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you next time.